Does anyone have a question?
When you and Gemma, you talk about tuning in, sort of like, you know, finding the sort of sparkling softness. I think this is a very big question. The question is, what is doing the tuning in?
So Stuji is saying, when Gemma and I speak about tuning in to the sparkling softness, etc. or whatever, to translate his gesture. What is doing the tuning in? And he also commented on his own question, saying, I think it's a very big question. Luckily related to my talk, but I won't just only leave it like that. So let's start with the more subtle first. Sometimes there's space, like we somehow accidentally left room. And then something by itself tunes in. And what that is, because your question is, what is it that tunes in? I'd rather say tuning in goes on. And it feels good. It feels good even when the tuning in that happens, when we've accidentally left room, so we forgot that we were in a hurry to be enlightened or to get to the lunch or whatever. And if we can also feel in the joke that Izzy is laughing at, that no one else is laughing at. That it's not that different to be in a hurry to get enlightened and to be in a hurry to get lunch first. So we can laugh already about that. That we think we're better when we're wanting enlightenment. But when room happens, so when space happens, what else there is comes more available. So what else there is other than hurry and impatience and not quite right feeling, wanting to fix it feeling. But what that is that does the movement is different depending on the person and the time of that person's practice and life and time of day and everything. So it can be more or less subtle what tunes in. So that it can be a crusty tuning in, like a tuning in like the whales that have just covered in the barnacles, you know, the whales that are covered in the crusty things. So it can be a crusty, like it's a beautiful, incredible, the biggest animal that ever lived, including dinosaurs, is our very own blue whale. And it comes along with all of these creatures living on its skin, so many that we can see and not see. So there can be this beautiful, immense movement that comes with bits, with stuff. And that might be tuning in, and I'm aware that I'm tuning in, I know I'm tuning in, I make myself a little bit tune in the way I think tuning in should be. I receive the experience of getting tuned in. according to what I think. So it can be mental crust, mental stuff, coming along with a very natural, huge movement. And the whales, my son is into animals, so they can communicate through the water like thousands of kilometers away. They can sing to each other. So even if the movement's crusty, it's even if it's full with stuff, even if it's got mental filter, it's a beautiful movement. It's a big movement, and it's wide. It's more than just that one thing. Sometimes the stuff that goes with the movement might be more emotional. But even so, we could still, it's just stuff on a huge whale, little stuff on a huge whale. So just that it feels good is enough to go on. So it feels good and the mind goes, ah, I got it, or whatever, I lost it, or whatever it does. Mind being thinking and emotion. That like the two main events with the mind. And I would like to say that the movement that happens when we leave room, that feels good. It feels good even when it brings us to an uncomfortable edge. It brings us out of who we thought we were, which is very uncomfortable, but it still feels good somewhere else. I would like to call it a movement from both sides, so to speak. So it's as if the small mind or the small version of myself, despite myself, meeting everything else that I am, so to say, everything else that is in that aliveness in me, that they move together, that it's a moving together. And that's why we can feel it, because what already is, that's mysterious, that's beyond our knowing, that is what we really are, is already there. And doesn't get mad at us when we ignore it. So it doesn't also get so excited when we recognize it. But there is a movement together. And I would just like to say, even if we could talk about it in other ways as well, just today I would like to call it the two sides meeting, something like that. It has a lot to do with our receptivity, which is what I'm saying when we've left some room by accident. When we're trying to leave room, trying to leave room, trying to leave room, we're busy trying to leave room, there's not so much room. It still can be a better practice than just getting taken over by. But if we then still have in mind that trying to leave room is different from leaving room, from room being left, from room. So sometimes we try to leave room. And that can mean sometimes I just allow all of this movement in my mind and body and so on. I just let it be. I leave it room. And other times, leaving room is like, no. I had enough of that story. Even if we know the story is coming back. I have a ridiculous metaphor for that. I don't know where it comes from. As if we ordered pizza and it came and we sent the delivery person away, closed the door, like, no. But we forgot to pay. And so the person comes back. So even if the story is going to come back at 20 seconds later maximum, it can be really important to say no. I didn't order pizza. Or I'm vegetarian, or I ordered sausage, or whatever. One thing I want to talk about again is, if I may go on. Did you want to go on? Go for it. Go for it. A crust on its back.
Yeah. So when I feel like the crust blocks everything, so the crust is, I don't know, a reaction, an emotional reaction to the experience of the whale moving, or, and then freaking out. And it feels like that type of crust can stop the whole. More accurate to be thinking that it sort of stops my small perception, but the whale is still.
Sometimes that's a helpful thought, and sometimes we have to stick with what we know, which is, if I don't feel the whale, I don't know if there's a whale. Just to not be tricky, not to get stuck with another nice thought. Sometimes it's a nicer thought that helps us get back to that, doesn't matter what I think, this feels good, in a different way. And it's anyway so far beyond what I could think about or perceive that whatever helps me get to that gliding into that good is good. So sometimes the thought, the whale's still there, I'm riding on the back of the whale anyway, holding on to the crust, helps. And sometimes it's important to know that the energy that's going by habit into thinking about what my experience is using energy in a habit. It's using energy in a habit. It's not leaving the energy free. So again, sometimes we can try to leave room, and that's all we can do. Sometimes through the goodness we glide into, there is room. Through the goodness, which is more usually down here, feeling feels good. So, but, and. When the thinking seems to stop my experience of the whale, or of that free movement, it seems that by practice, we can just notice that thinking seems to have stopped my experience of the whale. Thinking seems to have stopped a free movement. I know it doesn't, but that's my response to you. I might be wrong, but I'm saying I think it's thinking that's stopping you.
Well, it feels like cells are frightened.
Yeah.
And that it feels like that sparks much quicker than.
Yeah, that can be. Fear of that immensity.
I don't know what fear of.
Well, fear of death, basically. The death of what I know myself to be. When there can be in that moment, so in action. a real just staying true even when we get upset. The staying true in the face of the upset. I like the way Krishnamurti talks about this. He talks about it as creates a conflict. Creates a conflict between staying true and the upset. And still staying there, not then also freaking out to the conflict. But staying there with the staying true, he says, dissolves that habit, whatever it may be, that got us upset. It dissolves it. I think I even wrote that. He gives the example of if one of us maybe is a snob, which means it was a good example in India for Indians, especially, but we. Even if India, it's out in the open, India is a good place to learn about our own culture because it's out in the open. For example, class prejudice. This class is better than that class is better than that class. We have it as well, even though we think we're better than Indians because we don't have a caste system. So he said, for example, you're a snob and you don't know you're a snob. So obviously, that's a disturbance or distortion happening in the mind that we're not aware of. So it's getting in the way of a free life, and we don't know it. He says, don't try to figure out afterwards if you are being a snob then, and certainly don't bother thinking, he says, don't bother thinking about why you're a snob, etc., though there would be causes. Notice now what snob feels like. Stay true in the face of snob, and that creates a conflict. And staying there, let me see if I wrote down all the, yeah, he says, this creates conflict in my summary, which dissolves snobbery, which dissolves the snobness. So it's a cool experiential way to talk about mindfulness and non-duality without duality. And it gives us more information about what that experience is like when we stay true in the face of an unconscious habit. Or let's just call it where the mind is not free and we don't know it, that it creates conflict. So that was one thing I was trying to say last time, 2 days ago, about sometimes when we're just in the yumminess that some people feel with being fully with the body, it can be confusing when we then notice that we can also be mindful of the mind. Because as we're mindful of the mind, we're creating conflict, which is different from when we're with the body. The body loves mindfulness, usually. Not always, but even when there's pain, mindfulness of the pain can often, not always, dissolve the pain without so much conflict. It's more simple, maybe, because it's physical. May come to a head and then dissolve, or it may just, or it may not. But to know that we're looking for conflict when we really go to the point of being mindful of the mind, which means staying true. I like Ernest gave, sorry, on our first Open Dharma retreat 12 years ago, he gave this great definition of mindfulness, honesty. So another way to say staying true. Staying true in the face of distortion of the mind, upset. Will make more upset, will make more heat. And then we think we're doing something wrong, and we back off, we give up, usually. Or we make too much of it. It's just conflict between staying true and a distortion of the mind that doesn't matter where it came from, but we didn't know about it until right now. So inaction in the moment is Krishnamurti's suggestion. And also mine. So I want to just bring in, I saw you had a hand up, and I want to bring in a poem. Yeah? Okay. A poem, it's called a poem, it could be called something else, by E.E. Cummings, who was a really revolutionary poet from the U.S. in the 20th century. He was way ahead of his time, for example, in using only small letters most of the time. So his name is small e, small e, small c Cummings, like now we do all the time with text and internet. So small e, small I, Cummings. Love is a place. Some of you will need to find out what your word would be for love. So don't give up if that's not your word. Love is a place. Love is a place. And through this place of love, move. And then he has parentheses, so these curved. Love is a place, and through this place of love, move with brightness of peace. All places. So already we can have several meanings for what he said. That's why I'll keep going back to the beginning, also because I love the poem. Love is a place, and through this place of love, move with brightness of peace. All places. There might be a pause now, long pause, but it's not in his poem. Yes is a world. Yes is a world. And in this world of yes, live. Skillfully curled, skillfully curled, all worlds. And then there are some empty lines, blank space, and then there are the letters A-H, which I don't know for sure if they came from E.E. Cummings or from the friend who gave me the poem of E.E. Cummings. Either way is good. And it's part of what I want to talk about today, too. I'm going to read it again, if you don't mind. Small e, small e, small c, Cummings. Just imagine, on an old typewriter. Love is a place. And through this place of love, move. With brightness of peace. All places. Yes is a world. And in this world of yes, live. Skillfully curled. All worlds. So in case love isn't your word, he gave you yes as a second option. Still, you might have to find your own. But where you have experienced all worlds in that, skillfully curled, that word, yes, love, or another, any other word. Part of what I want to talk about is part of me what's happening here, that we are investigating mostly Indian spiritual traditions, And we are all not Indian. None of us, as far as I know, is Indian. Is that true? None of us has Indian background. Is it true? In your body, at least, physical. We could then feel unentitled. We could feel we don't have the right, we'll never get it right. Or we could feel we'll get it better because we have better perspective. We can throw away all of that crappy old crusty religion and just keep the essence. So just like this poem from E.E. Cummings from less than 100 years ago came to me from my friend Tracy, and I don't know already if "ah" is a crust or part of the original. To me, it's not so important, but it's important that I tell you, maybe. It might be from the original poem, it might not. I can find out, but I don't know. Another friend, Peter Friedlander from Australia, who is a Hindi scholar and professor. Likes to look at this, where poems and texts and teachings from mostly India, sometimes other places like the Middle East, so-called by Europeans, come to the modern world in new versions. And what's different about those versions, where they sometimes get more precise in a scholarly way, where they get sometimes more poetic or more easy for us to hear, for better and worse. What sometimes happened is the concepts here that we didn't have anything like that, like what we translate as mind, mano or man. We just call it mind or sometimes mind, heart. We don't really know what is meant by that word unless we actually learn some background or learn some context. And I want to give some of that context because it's a concept we don't have. It's a possible perspective. It might be helpful for us in getting getting closer to our inner experience. Man, mind, heart. Or again, I like how Krishnamurti talks about mind and its movements of thinking and emotion. I think that is a good bridge. An Indian like Krishnamurti, who was educated in the West and had Indian and Western students. I think it can be helpful to notice in our own experience. For example, we hear that we might want to be aware of the I thought. And so we look up here for a thought that says I. But in my experience, the experience of I thought is not only up here, but kind of at least like this, at least this much of me that feels I. So we could call it I mind, if we think mind is mind, heart, or we think about the possibility in India, they talk about mind as the sixth sense. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, all of those touch senses, which is more than one. So there's where am I in space, where's my hand, relation to my knee, to the ground, balance, temperature, texture, weight, density, etc. So touch and mind as just another way of receiving our experience. But mind happens to also receive all of those sense experiences too, and everything else that comes into our mind. So it's not quite the same, but just to think of the mind, sometimes our senses get excited. Sometimes our mind sense gets excited. Normal, no problem. Nothing to take seriously in the sense of nothing to get upset about, nothing to believe particularly. So just like hot is just hot, sometimes it's hot here, there's sweat, but it's just hot. Similarly, the mind gets hot, and it's just a hot mind. There are so many poems and songs and texts from traditions that are rooted in India, so that goes all the way from India through Tibet, China, and Japan, at least, where this word man would have been translated in different ways, and we wouldn't have understood. So it's almost like we could start again. I was just looking over again the retreat forms and why you came, and someone wrote, "It's not my first retreat," someone that I've known a long time. And I first read it as, "It's my first retreat," and I laughed. I thought he was making a joke. Kind of like to recover, in order to stay true better, to recover that as if this is my first retreat. To know that the man, the mind heart, is almost certainly distorting. It's almost certainly not straight. It's almost certainly not fully free right now and all before now. Even when we feel quite free, it's almost certainly not quite free. Can we feel that limitation without worry, without making it a problem, so simply, and also with the possibility of a richness that can come, just like when a text comes from someone's being through their mun, through their mouth, onto the paper or whatever, and then often can be translated hundreds of times, then from India into Tibetan, and then it's a whole different tradition, into Chinese, and it's a whole different tradition. Sometimes the earliest example of the text we have is from China, 224 in the Common Era, even though we know it came from earlier texts in India. And that starts to be clearly a richness rather than a problem. We don't know if there was an original text. So one great example that my friend Peter Friedlander comes with is a Buddhist text called the Dhammapada that I've never liked, I must say, because I got the wrong translations for my taste. Peter says that the British Library has 130 different versions of it. Some Chinese, some Tibetan, some different Indian texts, including the Pali. But already, even though this already thousands of years ago was considered, apparently was called, or at least 2,000 years ago, was called like the best Buddhist text. And still people in the West like to say that. People in India like to say that. There are some lines in the Dhammapada that are also in the Mahabharata, which is a Hindu text. And depending on which religion you're from, you can say which one is older and therefore more original. But maybe, like Krishnamurti, we could care less about exactly where it came from and try to let it come alive and be in action now. Someone named Muller put out a translation already in the 1800s that is still in print, still getting reprinted. And he deliberately put aside a more exact translation and deliberately kept a simplistic, moralistic translation for no good reason. And then how many translations based on that? So I think I must have read the ones that were based on that one. All partly because, as Westerners, we didn't know what mun means. This really simple problem. And then our possible snobbery, that if we don't have the concept, we must have a better one. And people wanting to make it similar to Christian texts at that time. I actually won't even read you that translation. But what more precise translations, what we now consider more precise translations of the text that happen to have survived? So if you can feel the joke of it, there probably might be some really original one somewhere that who knows what it says. Maybe in a Western language, who knows? It talks about Mun as being a leader of the rest of our experience, being a leader and a creator of its own faculties as well. So it's made of many things, and it's a leader of those things. So we can feel in ourselves, to be simple, when we're in a bad mood. The bad mood tends to lead our experience. And it tends to shape our receptivity, turn certain things off, certain things on. It tends to distort more, to distort itself more, to distort the mun more. And what I was trying to say last time is if we could then just stay true to that, that's all that's happening. Great. If we find ourselves thinking, speaking, and acting from that bad leader, we can firsthand experience that it sucks, that it's again more suffering. So we talked about last time suffering that we allow to lead to more suffering. Within and among the different translations, some of the different meanings for the lines of the Dhammapada are that mind is really fast. It'll be faster than everything else. Not everything else, but it'll be faster than our thinking and our, like the leadership of mind, if we can start to pinpoint that. The leadership of mind will be very fast, and it will lead our thinking and our emotion. And then certainly our speaking and our acting. And when we let that quick sense organ called mind be in charge, it will force us to let suffering make more suffering. If we let the small mind lead, suffering will bring more suffering. If we let a bright mind lead, ease, well-being, happiness, I would say a tendency towards a freeing of the mind follows us like a shadow that never leaves. Yeah. Maybe in a little different way. If we let an undistorted mind be there so that something else leads, this is how I will say it now, happiness happens. Like a shadow that never leaves. Another way to say it is if we let that possibility that even when the mind is distorted and we know it or don't know it, if we practice tapping into something else deeper, echoing a little bit with Stu's question, if we just don't let the distorted mind lead so much, staying true will allow the conflict to dissolve the distortion, to dissolve the problem, to dissolve the not yes, to leave room for the yes. So Cummings says that in the world, in this world of yes, live. Feeling for, even when we feel like no, or no, or no. So it might be aggressive, it might be defensive, it might be like trying to put the brakes on something. But if we say yes, this is happening, but also yes, that's not all that's happening. So I'm impatient, I'm bored, I'm whatever, but I'm freaking out. Yes. And the yes leaves room for another yes that loves that one kind of conflict of staying true in the face of what's not true and letting it dissolve, even if it hurts. It's a different kind of pain. There, suffering cannot impulse, cannot push, cannot force us into more suffering. Yes. I called it yes, and yes. Dhammapada says, describes it as a shadow that never leaves. Shadow to us has different connotations. If being in South India, that even in wintertime, I'm sweating sometimes, and I like hot weather. Shade is a treasure. Shade is what everybody needs. Shade is, when you grow a tree for shade for travelers, it's a huge act of generosity. When you grow a tree of shade for spiritual practitioners, people who want to meditate, it's a huge act of generosity. So shade means, which is anyway where I want to go next, good. Shade means two things. If we just take in this mix of translations also, shade means where you can stay still, where you can rest and not be hurt. Shade means coolness and freshness. The metaphor that describes what it feels like or what it's like when we let the distorted leadership happen in our man, he said, it says that a sense of not being okay, dukkha, follows like the wheel of the cart follows the foot of the bullock that carries it. So in South India, we can still see this happening. The bullock carries the cart and the wheel follows the bullock. One of the Tibetan versions of this line is typically Tibetan Buddhist, like kind of extreme and a bit violent, quite violent. There were two people, and one let the believed in that distorted mind and let it lead. And when taking rest by the side of the road in the shade of the tree, had his head cut off by a passing cart. So it's the same cartwheel, wheel of the cart, about suffering, but it's quite, if you know Tibetan Buddhism, it really fits the vibe of that more tantric kind of wild flavor. And then the other one was safely sleeping in the shade of the tree, and the shade didn't move. Even if the sun was moving, the shade stayed. So, a coolness and a kind of sense of another kind of protection, mysterious protection, we can gather if we want from these different traditions. That can come by staying clear and bright with what is distorted and not believing it, not letting it lead, not letting it pull the cart, but just staying in the shade. Maniji, yeah.
I just want to get some clarification.
Good, yeah.
Okay, sometimes in the morning, I get up, I make my tea. Something happens while I'm making the tea that shows me that I'm in a bad mood.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware of it before.
Yeah.
But the milk spills or something, and then I just,
Yeah.
Now, okay, usually I try to calm down, you know, hey, you know. But, so you're saying in this, just stay with the I am in a bad mood. This has happened to me. I'm a nice guy. I don't deserve this. and so
what else is going on? This is going on.
Yes.
This, and I notice this seems to be a distortion. This seems to be a okay.
Yes.
And sometimes it helps what Lenny's saying. It might not help, it might help depending on the individual. It might help to say, I'm not all bad, I'm a nice guy, I don't deserve this. But we could also come from another side where we just say, this is happening. Not to me, this is happening. And it feels like it's happening to me, so that's that I thought, that I experience. And then I get really clear sense of what is the shape of the I experience, or what I prefer to call the small mind experience. There it is. Small, tight, uncomfortable, embarrassed to be uncomfortable, etc. That's where it's leading, the cart. But just seeing all of that movement, okay, yes, all of that movement. Yes, blech. Okay. Yes to that in the sense of, yes, this is happening. But not yes in the sense of, this is me and I've got to get rid of it because... But yes, this is happening, and yes, it's painful. And yes, to something else. That's okay anyway, we could say. That's one way to talk about it. So, yes to this living that can allow the mess, yes to the mess, without that just naturally doesn't let the cart get pulled. Staying in the shade, noticing the cart and the wheel, staying in the shade, cool, fresh, protected in the sense of actually untouched by that small mind, by that me. So those statements can help me notice that I'm actually not that small me that's nice anyway and doesn't deserve this. That those can be steps out of the small mind. But it's without pushing it away, which would again be the bull leading the cart. So your steps that work for you are to say, I'm a nice guy. I don't deserve this. That's a way of saying, this is not me. Even though I have a tendency to think it's my fault, I've got to fix it before anyone notices, this is something to be ashamed of. Instead of just, this is painful, this movement is painful. The fact of noticing it is not necessarily painful in the same way. The fact of noticing it can be the start of that kind of conflict that Krishnamurti talked about. I'm staying true to that bigger yes in the face of the small no or whatever, the small distortion, in the shade of the big yes, in the face of the fear of letting that small mind be gone, die, not be important, etc. I want to just put this very briefly, hopefully in 1 minute, into context with what I spoke about yesterday, 2 days ago, with the four doorkeepers that you might remember. So we had the playfulness, which is still mostly what we're talking about. Playfulness means like leaving room so that we can feel the bigger yes. By saying, yes, this is happening. This I can feel this movement, I can feel that it's painful. The distortion is painful because it's not true. Even if the distortion is, I'm so excited because I feel love for all beings and maybe I'm gonna be enlightened now or bring everyone into enlightenment with me or whatever. Like it could be a good state, but there's some distortion going on. There's some not true. And we have a kind of radar, we have a sensitivity to not true. And it takes practice to just land right on that place that can notice, this is movement, this hurts. Yes, and yes. That's not all that's happening. There's a living quality that is fresh, cooling. Usually, we might feel it as warmth sometimes, depending on our approach. That's untouched by the mess, by the movement, without in any way wishing to get rid of it. It's totally including that and no longer calls it mess. But is in conflict in another way. So that is playfulness. And that leaves more room for being moved in a way that's not a compulsion of the mind. So it's not the distorted mind forcing us, making us go in a particular direction. So we could call it utter openness. Utter openness. Like, that movement that's a more deeply natural movement that can happen when we've let noticing playfully kind of burn through. So noticing in action, staying true with a current state. Like in the morning, I'm making my tea. Because I spilled the milk, I notice I'm in a bad mood. Cool. Bad mood. Yeah. I can feel how that hurts by going with it, and I can feel how just staying still, there's a different kind of thing going on, a different kind of heat going on. By helping myself get there, by reminding myself I don't deserve this, I'm a nice guy, so, or any way that we find that's very natural to each of us. Some people need to own it more, some people need to disown it more to find that playful place. And then dissolving happens. So then we're in the possibility of another kind of movement that's not forced upon us, so to say, from the past direction. It's a free, the directions are open. E.E. Cummings says that in the way of saying yes is a world, and in this world of yes, live, skillfully curled, all worlds. So to recognize what I'm saying, that moments where it felt like everything was present with you, there was nothing that wasn't there or here. Sometimes in the detail of feeling my foot on the ground, by being so precise and absorbed in immersion, there's non-separation without needing to consciously, mentally acknowledge all the objects in the world. And sometimes with other flavors, like, for example, eyes wide open, chest wide open, the world that we see here and how that seems to contain skillfully curled all worlds, including that world of suffering that creates suffering, no problem. Including happiness and including the mysterious depth that has no bottom, where we actually live. And so we can start to acknowledge there's no bottom and we still live. We don't have to make a bottom or pretend to make something to sit on. The support that we need is that place that has no bottom. From there, these movements come that has a sense of just being open and something comes. That's the second doorkeeper. So I just wanted to start to put that into the context of the four doorkeepers.
What is the second doorkeeper? No bottom.
from no bottom or from the shade. Or from the big yes. Having done the first yes, the second yes. You can call it the first doorkeeper is the first yes, the second doorkeeper is the second yes. Mm-hmm. Or from the second yes, what happens? Which is not contrived and not forced. It's not a momentum from the past. That's the main thing. It's fresh. So from the shade, whether we actually wake up or get up or move or not, another kind of movement that's not from the past. Yeah. So it's more like from the second yes, what happens, what atmosphere is actually very atmospheric. Like,
wow.
So it's the last line that Tracy added to E.E. Cummings' poem, or E.E. Cummings added to E.E. Cummings' poem. Ah, that's really the second doorkeeper, we could say. Anything else, briefly, before we end?
Yeah, just one question.
Yes, Katrin.
I understand what you're saying, but you know, sometimes you just you're so much into this, like I cannot enjoy walking. I cannot go to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I understand it, even though I understand that I'm upset and that I should take a step back. You know, but just It's just impossible sometimes, you know, because you're so much into this.
Yeah. So the contradictory trick is when we're so into it that even though I know I could and kind of should step back, the should is the signal.
And that even gives you more pressure.
Because I think I should not be here, I'm not fully letting this be yes. This is happening. So the contradiction is that because I'm not fully with it, it's fully eating me up and I can't find a way out. Even though I know there's a way out, I'm not willing to go on it. I can't find that willingness to go out. So more allowing, or depending on how you feel, better, like more just noticing the resistance. So partly we want to say, yeah, I'm so bored, I'm out of here, this sucks. But also we can feel the resistance to that, even though something in us wants to, because of the resistance, be like, more emphatic with it, more strong with it. So sometimes we could feel more the resistance to the difficult. Two kinds: resistance to the idea that I'm in a bad mood or that I'm upset or I'm impatient. The idea of it, we don't like. It looks bad on our resume, on our self-image. And also, we can come down to the ground of where there's just resistance to the pain of that state. And if we can come there, it starts to be much easier. Things start to fall apart a little bit. It just hurts. So if we can notice there's resistance to the idea, sometimes that helps us then notice there's also resistance to the pain, which is just hot or just heavy. It's actually not such a big deal. And then it's easier for us to be interested in walking out of the ring of fire. It's so hot here. Why is it so hot here? Ah, oh, it's all my fault or whatever, or all their fault. But then, oh, it's so hot. It's really hot. And then we notice there's a way out. And we just naturally walk out by simply feeling that the pain of that, impatience, jealousy, anger, fear, insecurity, etc., snobbery, arrogance, whatever, the pain of our idea of it, resisting that, and the pain of it, there can be some more gentleness. Oh my goodness, that comes naturally. This is really hot, but it's actually not so hot. And then that second yes happens, which is noticing that's not all that's happening. There's something untouched.
So you think if it feels unbearable, it's because I didn't step back enough, right?
But I'm suggesting that you maybe step almost into it more as a way. But knowing what I mean, it doesn't mean believing, but just feeling. And feeling really honestly, like it's something that hurts and resistance to that, and that also hurts, for example. But already there, it's like it hurts because it's not true. It's not staying true. Thinking, when we're in it, it's as if that's all, and that's not true. And it doesn't fit us because there's freedom loving in us. It's not freedom, it's distortion. Thank you for listening.